So I chose Magnolia because I think it's a movie that is engaging in really interesting ways with the aftermath of being in a dysfunctional family, themes of familial violence and neglect, and the ways that individuals cope with experiencing those things in adulthood, the way that the past crops up in the present. That's a theme of my work and something that I'm really interested in.
Welcome back to Open Form. I'm Michael Denzel Smith. The longtime host of the TV quiz show, What Do Kids Know?, has just learned that he has cancer. The current, reluctant child star of the show, whose knowledge is vast and impressive for a preteen, has to pee really badly. A former star of the show has spent all the money he doesn't have on braces in hopes of winning the affection of a local bartender. The show's original producer is on his deathbed, and his wife is spiraling about the false nature of their marriage. The caretaker has been tasked with finding the producer's estranged son, who is a minor celebrity peddling self-help tapes to men who shouldn't be let anywhere near the women they're learning to manipulate. This week's film is Magnolia, and it was chosen by Chantal V. Johnson, author of the novel Post-Traumatic.
I also think that it's a movie that ultimately is very much aligned with survivors and victims of the family. Many of the characters are given a lot of, and maybe too much, we can talk about this, cinematic space to, for instance, go on long monologues, as Donnie does. They're given space to like enact rage against their parental figures, which we see in the characters of Claudia and Frank. They're allowed to kind of explode with anger at their abusive fathers. And I think growing up, it was rare for me to see a movie that was a popular film, or like a mass, for a film for like mass consumption that was dealing with these themes in a way that I felt was aligned with survivors and humanizing them, and insisting that their point of view mattered. The other, and then I also just love, because I'm a big music fan, I love that all of this is set to the music of Amy Mann, who's one of our most underrated songwriters. And in fact, Paul Thomas Anderson has said that he was inspired by one of her songs, Deathly, to write this movie, and he wanted to make her music central to the film.
As you said that, I've seen Magnolia probably two or three times at this point. I love Paul Thomas Anderson's films, but Magnolia, because of its 3-hour runtime, is not one that I like
Yes.
rewatch a whole lot. But I had not considered that perspective of the way that this is sort of like a reckoning with family and familial ties and the abuse that takes place therein. I hadn't really thought of it, but it makes so much sense as you say it, in thinking about the different characters that we have. Because I think also part of it is that, like, what the film sets up for you in those first few scenes with the narrator and these sort of historical examples of like coincidence, right? Like, you're primed for thinking of what are these like serendipitous sort of connections that are being made between these characters, and like how like all of this world is connected, and even as they experience different forms of tragedy, right? Like, there's still various connections playing out that like one leads to the other, and then one, like, so I think that that was that with a framing is sort of like the way that I was consuming it. But I also picked up on something else that I'm curious to hear you talk about, but I did not immediately sort of register the familial part of it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I after we kind of locked down that we were going to watch this one, I rewatched Hard Eight and Boogie Nights. And so I wanted to do them sequentially. So yeah. I did Heart Eight and Boogie Nights. And what struck me was that both of those movies are kind of like about forming a surrogate family because your original one didn't work out. Like in Heart Eight, the guy is like, you know, adopting a new son, essentially, that he kind of becomes his mentor. He adopts John C. Reilly and a strangely cast Gwyneth Paltrow to be his new son and daughter. And it doesn't quite work out, but like that's what he does. And then in Boogie Nights, it's a very similar thing where Dirk Diggler like leaves his abusive parental home to find a chosen family amongst, you know, in the pornography industry.
Yeah.
And so then you have Magnolia coming third. And for me, when I watched it after watching those two, it was like, oh, so Magnolia shows you the reasons why people need to find the chosen families from Heart Eight and Boogie Nights.
Interesting. Because on this watch of it, what I was taking note of more so was it felt like there's a sort of examination of like fame, but a particular kind of fame, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not A-list fame that we've sort of like told that story over and over again. It's this like particular localized fame, right? Like a momentary fame, striving for fame in some way. Like there's this way in which all of these very flawed characters like become obsessed with or are subjected to the dictates of what it means to become famous or the attempts to become famous that play out in these various ways that always sort of end up tragically, right? Like no one escapes what fame hath wrought. And it's not even something that like, with the exception of one character, the game show host, right? Like maybe, and he's not even like particularly the biggest name in the world. It's just he's been hosting the show for a long time, right? Like it's that there's something destructive inherent in seeking fame or the achievement of certain levels of fame that like don't inoculate you from a regular life.
Yeah. And it also raises this kind of question, this pre-Me Too question of like, of what the entertainment industry is based upon. Like if the patriarch of the network, Earl Partridge, is, you know, he has committed this sin of abandoning his son and abandoning his dying wife, you know, how is that related to all of the, like, it's like this fruit of the poison tree idea, you know, like the entire system is tainted in part because it's built upon exploitation. It's built upon kind of abandoning your family in pursuit of work or in pursuit of fame. Like you said, and abandoning your kind of ethical relationship to the people in your life in order to pursue something that's very selfish and greedy.
Yeah. And it's just the various characters. So like the Tom Cruise character who, I mean, let's just stop to say, I think this is just Tom Cruise's best performance that he's ever given. Right?
100% agree.
Just, it's phenomenal. And I don't think that he's ever touched it. It's just the way that like, but you look at a character like that who has a particular kind of fame, and like we can look at him as a sort of analog to an era of pickup artist and stuff like that. But like in that particular time of like selling these quote unquote like self-help tapes and books to a specific set of people, that he amasses an amount of fame within that world. But it requires him a denial of his own past to create this persona, this character, in order to achieve it. There's the, you know, the Donnie character who was famous as a child, and it's like, now how does he navigate living as an adult? Where like he feels it's basically he's incapable of doing like the thing that he gets stuck on is like, I have so much love, I don't know how to give it, I don't know how to express it, essentially. But like, he doesn't know how to like work, right? Like,
he doesn't know how to
just navigate like being an adult and talking to, holding a conversation with someone else. And then you start to make that connection to the character Stanley, who is thrust into this because of his like immense intelligence, but he's very shy, very reserved, very, very closed, right? But where's the support system? And he's able to see it at some point, but it comes at a huge cost to him. I'm just saying that like, there's so many different points at which all of these characters are wrestling with the expectation of fame and celebrity culture in these like ways that feel minor to us when we consider the largesse of celebrity.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I'm also interested in the way that because this movie is an ensemble and because of the way that it's edited and filmed, when you start talking about one character, I think we've both done it, you also then start talking about like the three other characters that you could like cluster them with.
Yeah.
And I just like, that's so interesting to me that we're both doing that. I feel like the film encourages you to do that. Like, I'd love to talk about like, after we get away from the coincidences, when we get into what is actually the movie, like that first 6 minutes is incredibly harried and kinetic.
Yeah.
And it's all to that Amy Mann song, One. Mm. And we're being introduced to each of these characters with like 30 to 45 seconds. And for me, like that beginning, I watched it a few times in preparation for this conversation. And it struck me that it's like a masterclass in quickly developing character.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's just like, you're immediately seeing Frank Mackey's, you know, misogyny on TV.
Yeah.
And then that's connected to Claudia because the TV is playing in the bar. And then she's doing coke and having like mindless sex at her apartment while she's watching, potentially watching her father's TV show. Mm-hmm. And then we go to him and he's like cheating on his wife with someone, you know? And it's just like, and then we see Stanley and he's associated with all the books. And his father is like berating him and saying, I have to get to an audition. And it's just like, it's so fast and rapid fire. And I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to watch the movie for the first time without knowing how anyone's connected to each other. Like, it just, it feels like the director is kind of just dominating you and being like, I'm not going to tell you, like, you have to like pay attention. Or you're going to miss stuff. You're not going to know how these people are connected unless you pay attention.
Yeah, I can say from remembering my first time, it's confusing. And it's exactly that. It's a demand that you pay attention. And I think that that's like, it's interesting to think of that in terms of like being a 1999 demand, when we're obsessed with the idea that people have a short attention spans now because of the internet, because of like YouTube, because of social media, that all we want is like quick things. That like, no, in 1999, also Paul Thomas Anderson is saying, no, you have to sit down and you have to pay attention to this. And I think that that's just a product of like every sort of generation believing that, you know, there's something that the new generation is missing. And it's like there's some deficiency in the way that you go about things. And so it's like, okay, in 1999, you think, okay, well, it's not going to be a big disaster movie. It's not going to be a big alien movie. You have to sit down and think about this. And it's like, well, that could be in response to any cultural moment in which we think of. But I'm thinking now though about what you said with respect to it being like this family movie, but it also being that like dissection of a certain type of fame and those things in conversation together. In that, like, it feels like the one thing is supposed to be able to provide a level of support to help you survive the other, right? Like, you're supposed to be able to rely on family in order, and those like deep bonds that keep you grounded, that like are able to check you, that are able to love and support you. But in this film, it's basically like, without any of that, with those bonds broken by various means, there's no chance of survival on the other side of any level of fame.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, each of the characters kind of have to eke out. I mean, I think it's an open question of how they each end up, how and whether they each end up eking out a way to survive. Mm. I do kind of feel like at least the kind of the quartet of Stanley, Frank, Claudia, and Donnie, probably the characters that I'm the most interested in because they play into my argument about the aftermath of abuse and neglect. I think they all have a kind of potentially hopeful ending. You know, I think we see dark sides of all of their journeys, but I do think that there's hope at the end for each of them. And I think, I mean, one thing that I love about the movie too is that it's not forcing everyone to forgive their families, but there is forgiveness in it. You know, some characters forgive and some don't. You know, I don't think Claudia forgives her father for molesting her, but Frank does seem to forgive Earl, you know, and they have that moment of connection, like eye contact at the end. But maybe Claudia forgives herself. You know, she doesn't necessarily forgive her father, but she forgives herself. There's that way that Jim kind of, I mean, he forgives Donnie for committing a crime, which we can talk about the depiction of the cop in the movie as well. But I think that the film is a bit kind of ambiguous or ambivalent about forgiveness, about reconciliation. It doesn't like totally promote it, but it does, you know, and that's the benefit of having so many characters is that you can take a single theme and you can explore it in, you know, myriad ways.
Do you want to talk about the depiction of the cop?
it was, you know, it's so interesting watching these movies now, you know, and, you know, it's so clear that that in 1999, he's supposed to be a sympathetic figure. We know that John C. Reilly and Paul Thomas Anderson are friends, and that Paul C. Reilly was in both of the movies that preceded Magnolia, and that PTA was always just trying to find roles for John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of the bumbling cop is kind of a trope. And so I think he is meant to provide some comedic relief. But in watching it now, it's just interesting to see how horrible he's being to everyone. You know, he's treating everyone horribly. You know, he's hitting on a woman that he's, you know, he's responding to a call at her house and she's clearly coked up. And then he arguably takes advantage of that by asking her out on a date, you know?
Yeah.
You know, he totally dismisses the young black kid who's trying to offer him clues to, as soon as I saw that little kid, I was like, okay, how magical is this Negro? Like my magical Negro scale of one, on a scale of 1 to 10, just how magical is he going to be? I think he's like a 4, maybe a 4 or a 5.
He's,
he saves Julianne Moore's
right?
life.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yes, okay, so maybe he's a 6.
Oh man, I would love to see the magical Negro scale like that. I've
invented it here today. We should apply it to other movies.
I think to everything that you're saying, I think that we're meant to sympathize with him as just like this guy that's doing his best. He's like a little incompetent, but like who among us, right? And then it's just like, well, who among us is incompetent but also has a gun and is the license to kill?
Right.
Like, but I also found it in terms of thinking about that fame piece, it's like he's not famous, right? But what he does do is narrate his experience as if he's on an episode of Cops.
Yes.
Right. And I think that you when you're thinking about that, you think about the level of influence then on the idea that your own subjective narrative is going to be interesting enough to other people that they would want to hear your thoughts about Reddit, right? And I'm like, I'm a writer of nonfiction and I like put myself in there. And so I'm not acting as if I'm absolved in this, the idea that like, oh yeah, of course you want to hear from me. But like to think that the banality of his job, because like everything that he does is really banal, right? Like he's just sort of answering calls that have no bearing on anyone's actual safety, right? Like there's nothing there, but he's trying to convince himself of his own importance by narrating it as the way that he's seen on this popular television show.
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't quite understand what that narration was, because at the beginning it felt like it was a personal ad that he was saying that he wants to meet some. So I just thought that he was recording it for a personal ad. But then when he comes back at the end and he's monologuing about forgiveness, I was like, wait, is this not a personal ad?
Okay. There is the personal ad that he's like recording to find a date, right? Yeah. Like he is doing that part, but then he's just sort of sitting in his car and riding down the street and narrating like what he thinks about the job and like all these ideas. And it's like, I don't know, like, who cares?
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas I loved that Donnie got all of the space to just be a sad sack drunk at the bar delivering monologues. Like I actually did care about his monologues. And I loved his whole arc. I loved that character so much. Mm. I had forgotten how much I loved it. I loved that he's constantly listening to that song Dreams by Gabrielle. Like it was just all of it was pitch perfect and amazing. The scene when we first see Brad's braces and then what's the actor's name? Michael C. Hall. Is that his name? The guy who plays Donnie. I don't remember his name. But
God.
They all have three names. Everybody in this movie. But he, as soon as he sees Brad, we see Brad's braces. And this is like, I don't know, this is an hour into the movie. So I also love that. Like you see him getting fitted for the braces in the beginning. You have no idea why, because his teeth are perfect. And then it's like an hour later, we see that he's like in love with this himbo who has braces. And when we see the braces, then Donnie licks his teeth. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, I got teary-eyed. I was so touched. And then that whole scene with him at the bar and his like the nemesis who can give Brad what he needs, which is money, which is like what Donnie doesn't have.
Yeah.
And they're engaged in these kind of philosophical debates that you can get into at the bar with alcoholics, you know, of like, you know, the villain, his nemesis is very much, he has a philosophy that's very similar to Frank Mackey of like, you know, you have to get over the past. Mm-hmm. You have to just get over it. Like you're being pathetic. And Donnie is insisting that he has a right to be marooned on the past, you know, because of all of these horrible things that have happened to him. And in the end, you know, his arc is hopefully that he can kind of get over that and move beyond that. But I love that he's given the space to like use his intellect to, you know, modify all of those dumb quotations that the villain is coming at him with, you know, where he's like, who was it that said that, you know, a genius is a man who can only be ruined by himself, you know, and Donnie's like, well, but that person didn't have parents who took, you know, like his parents didn't shit on him and they didn't take all of his money and he wasn't electrocuted by lightning, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, it just hit so hard on the kind of the way that people who have experienced a lot of stuff really can get stuck on that.
Yeah.
And feel like, you know, you can almost feel like you're special or you've been chosen. You know, he's talking about how he's been struck by lightning. Like, that doesn't happen to everybody. Like, I was struck by lightning because he's trying to find meaning. He's trying to find a narrative to understand.
Yeah.
Like, why me? Why was I struck by lightning? Is it because I'm special? I have to be special, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, maybe, but maybe not.
Probably not.
Right? Probably not.
Probably
right?
not.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, it is a question that I think like most of us wrestle with in terms of how much are we defined by our history, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard to ask that question in the social and political context that we live in and only allow it to live as an individual question, right? Because we have to account for the ways in which history does inform the ways in which we interact with one another now, the ways that we have built structures and norms and mores that like dictate the way that our relationships play out with one another now. Like we have to account for that. But then when we individualize it, what we're asking is, how much are you going to allow your history, your past, to dictate how you move forward? And that's, it becomes tricky because it's like, yes, I am a product of my past. I am a product of my childhood. But I also know that like there have to be ways to move beyond it. But how to move beyond it? I mean, I talk to my therapist about this all the time, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and it's such a tough one to sort of unpack. And I think that like each character here is trying to wrestle with that question in their own ways.
For sure. And it's interesting to me to see the little acts of rebellion that start to pop up. Like, mm-hmm. I think they kind of start to crop up maybe in the second half or the last third. The one I'm thinking about in particular is when Stanley, the little kid, after he pees mm-hmm. himself,
yeah.
and he just refuses to go up and compete.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me was like this moment of like, and it's an utterly beautiful moment. It's beautifully filmed. It reminded me of, I was just telling my partner this, that I realized when rewatching it that he looks like the actress who plays Joan of Arc in Carl Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc. I actually have her on my t-shirt. But she, you know, in that movie, she has a bowl cut. Mm-hmm. And that movie is about Joan of Arc's trial. Mm-hmm. And it's based on transcripts of her trial. And she's in shackles. And it's a silent movie. And so much of it is just close-ups of her face. Mm-hmm. And she has a bowl cut and like a round collar. And Stanley is wearing a turtleneck. And he has a bowl cut. And there's just this extreme close-up on his face as he starts to begin like a kind of counter interrogation of Jimmy Gator. And he delivers his monologue of like, you know, I'm not a prop. I'm not a doll. You know, you think that you can laugh at me. Why? Because I'm smart. Why do you do that, Jimmy? Like, why? You know? And it was just this beautiful, powerful. I also love that show, the quiz show, is called What Do Kids Know?
What do kids
know? Is very on the nose, because it turns out kids in this movie know a lot. They know for instance, so like when they're being abused, you know. I love that it's literally adults versus children.
Yeah.
Which is, again, that's like one of the themes of the movie. It's so on the nose. It's so, there's so many things about this movie where it's like, they're kind of imperfections, or it's like too much, but it doesn't matter. Like, I love that this movie is imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
I love that there's an Amy Mann sing along, and I love that frogs rain from the sky. Like, can we talk about those two things as
I was
like
gonna ask how
creative
you felt
choices?
About the sing-along, because I feel like that's the I feel like the sing-along is the dividing point for a lot of critics, right? Like, that they're like, oh yeah, this is great, this is genius, until we get to the sing-along.
Well, it's either sing-along or frogs, you know. You either can't handle yeah. one of those. I love both. So for me, there's this kind of camp aspect to it that I really, that I really just like. And I think, I mean, I'm so curious what you think, but I just, both the sing-along and the frogs, they're both ways of kind of almost like pivoting into another genre. And so I think that's part of why people might not like it. But I guess yeah. for me, like, it was already melodrama from the beginning when we, these constant violins, you know, it's just literally like aggressive, speedy, anxiety inducing violins and like the blasting Amy Mann music. Like there's often scenes where if you're not watching it with closed captioning on, you can't hear the dialogue.
Yeah.
Because the music is so loud. And but for me, I loved this thing along. I mean, it's like, who among us, I love that it begins with Claudia, like, you know, preparing to do lines of coke, and she's just sitting in the dark crying, singing to Amy Mann. I mean, who hasn't done that? You know, who hasn't been sitting in the dark crying, listening to Amy Mann doing drugs? I mean, come on. When the dying man, the Jason Robards character, when he's singing it from the bed, that's getting to a point of like, this is a bit ridiculous.
I think this is where I come down, is that like, I'm fine with the sing-along. I think the execution isn't totally there just because I feel like we catch them at moments that I'm not totally sure that all of them would be singing, right? Like, and so, but I'm fine. Like, it doesn't detract at all. I love the frogs, right? Like, I just love, I love that moment of like the feeling of total absurdity with it, right? And it also, there's that moment that there's a shot of something on the wall, like a poster or something, and it says, but it did happen. And it's just like, yeah, strange shit just happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you can't explain it. You can't, like, if you weren't there, it's really hard to understand that it happened. If you were there when it happened and you're trying to explain it to someone, they are going to think of you as insane. But strange shit just happens sometimes, and there's no accounting for it. And I think that that's really what it is to me, is just being like, look, we can talk about the coincidences and all of this stuff, but like, also shit just happens. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just raining frogs. And sometimes that shit just happening is destructive, and it's disruptive of your life. And it's like, I have no idea how this got here. I don't know how I've managed to be in this situation. And then you have to pick up from it. How do you pick up from raining frogs, right? Like, that's really a question. And you can make that applicable across the number of questions in your life where you're just like, why? Why would this happen? And it's like, because, just because.
Yeah. And I love some of the plot function that it has. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it keeps Jimmy Gator from committing suicide because the frog hits the gun. It forces Donnie to fall on his face, thus ironically destroying the braces that he just got. And then Jim is then like allowed to save him. So he's like finally being the cop that he wants to be. And then it allows Stanley, that's just one of my favorite scenes again, where we go back to Stanley, who's broken into the library of the school and is just looking out calmly, dispassionately, and saying, this is a thing that happens because he's read about it. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful to me that he's just like, this happens. This is a thing that happens. You know, and whether he's talking about like literal frogs falling or what you're talking about, the larger thing of like things happening that are out of your control.
Yeah.
You know, but he's just wisely beyond his years saying this is a thing that happens. It's so beautiful. And I also think it's like, I don't know, like, I don't really know much about religion, so I don't know anything about frogs raining from the sky, though I do know that that's in the Bible. Yeah. But to me, it's like showing that the director is God. Because he's like, now I can just make frog. I can literally just decide to put frogs raining from the sky in my movie. And I can do that. And that is a thing that I can do after I did Boogie Nights and I get Final Cut and total creative control.
Exactly. Chantal, what's one lasting image that sticks with you from Magnolia?
Ooh, yeah. I think I've talked about a few. Like I said, I love the reveal of Brad's braces for some reason. I just thought that was just so wonderful. And the way it was so far away in time from Donnie getting fitted for his braces. I also talked about Stanley's beautiful face and the Joan of Arc reference. And that also fits into my idea of these children and adult children of abuse and neglect being kind of like revolutionary figures, you know, to the extent that he's being compared to visually compared to Joan of Arc. I think that that's interesting to me and that really works. And then when I was just watching it, I had forgotten how it ends. I had forgotten that it ends with Jim coming into Claudia's room, which is an echo of the way that her father came into her room at the beginning of the movie, which is like, you know, a survivor victim's worst nightmare is like seeing the person who assaulted you in your bedroom.
And she
violently raged against him when that happened. But at the end of the film, Jim comes into her room and sits on her bed, which she allows. And he delivers a monologue to her about how, like, he's not going to, he, like, she shouldn't talk about herself so negatively. She's a sweet and smart and wonderful person. And he's gonna, like, be there for her and potentially gonna be this source of secure love and attachment. And now again, because there's music playing, you kind of don't hear that. Unless you have to watch it with the, I'm just like, how did this work in the theater exactly? I don't even know. But the final image of the movie is the survivor of sexual abuse looking into the camera and smiling. Like, she breaks the fourth wall and she smiles. And so it's just this, it's this wonderful, hopeful moment that, like, maybe she's gonna get some of that love and security that she didn't get in childhood. And it's just so beautiful. And I had completely forgotten that it ends like that. I just utterly loved it.
Okay, so these are meant to be quick questions, but they never are for people.
Yes.
What is your all-time favorite film?
I have no idea. I mean, this is so hard. There's 20, you know? So I don't know how anyone answers that movie or answers that question. I will say, like, the movies that I rewatch over and over, North by Northwest is one. Mm-hmm. I think it's just completely rewatchable. It's very cozy. It inspired so much of contemporary cinema. So every time I watch it, I realize that, like, oh, so-and-so I think was inspired by this, like some of those chase scenes and some of the cinematography. It's just a beautiful movie. There's martinis in it and just like great, great costuming. it's wonderful. And then, you know, there's just a bunch of romantic comedies that I always rewatch. I probably watch Keeping the Faith once a year, which is just a random, but it's Keeping the Faith is one of my favorite movies about friendship and New York and romance. And it's just a wonderful feel good movie. And there are like dozens of others.
Yeah. And then lastly, what's a film that best captures the idea of family for you?
I mean, I guess I have a few answers because I don't like a lot of movies that are about nuclear bio families, I really don't. So I tend to gravitate more towards the kind of chosen family, queer family movies. Almodovar is great at that. I mean, he kind of mixes the two, bio family and then like people, orphans and friends and, you know, queer people that are just all coming together to be a family. So that's, you know, and the kind of like boys on the side, like women are escaping abusers and the patriarchy and forming their own kind of collective. I like that kind of stuff. But in terms of bio families, a couple of movies come to mind. One is Secrets and Lies by Mike Leigh, which is a really fantastic movie about family. It's about a middle-class Black British woman going to find her birth mother, who is a white working class woman who has a very dysfunctional family. And so it's very interesting because the Black woman is higher class than her white mother. I love that. And she's coming into this incredibly dysfunctional white family. And it's very interesting. And then there's this German film called Toni Erdmann that came out in 2016, which is about a woman and her relationship with her estranged father, who's trying to kind of win her back. And he is an actor and a prankster. And so he takes on disguises to get back into her life. And it's really funny and beautiful and touching. And so I would say all of those.
Chantal, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me on. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for listening to Open Form, a podcast from Lit Hub Radio, produced by Eliza Smith and Justin Alvarez, and hosted by me, Michael Denzel Smith. Feel free to like, comment, and subscribe to Open Form wherever you get your podcasts, and or sign up for the Lit Hub newsletter to stay up to date on our latest episodes. If you're enjoying what you hear, share Open Form with a friend or on social media. Next week, what do our dreams have to say about the beginning and end of civilization?